Ever be driving down the street and you hear a siren and you see the lights flashing as an ambulance comes up behind you and you've got to move over and you think to yourself, yeah, I wonder what's going on in there. Well, my next guest could probably tell you in detail because he spent 10 years as a paramedic and writes about that experience in a brand new fascinating book called 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. Kevin Hazard, welcome to the Big 550.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Nice to have you on here. By the way, do most people get out of the way okay?
No. No, it usually turns into a circus. You get out of panic, and people go in all directions, or they just ignore you. Plenty of people just ignore you.
Is it fun to drive an ambulance?
It's probably as fun as it is frustrating, because when you're trying to get through traffic in a hurry, it can make you want to put your head through a wall. But, it's fun to zip over, cross a double yellow line, go the wrong way up a one-way street, blow red lights. It has its moments.
But you did not think it was fun the first time, did you?
No, not at all. Not one bit. I was sort of thrown into it with almost no training, scared to death.
I would just think that most people would go, let me turn on the sirens and go as fast as I want. But well, you got a life in the back there that you got to worry about.
Yeah, well, you think that maybe for a few seconds, and then you realize that you're driving a 15,000-pound vehicle and up the wrong way and crossing the line and blowing red lights, stop signs. You realize really quickly how easily you could smash into someone. So it goes from fun to a lot of work in a hurry.
The book is called 1,000 Naked Strangers. Were most of the people you dealt with naked?
You know, an awful lot are. It's a bit surprising, actually, how many people find themselves in a compromising position at the exact moment that they have a medical emergency. But then I guess when you think about it, plenty of your life is spent in a compromising position.
When you say compromising position, did you come up on people who were caught in the act of sex or something like that?
I was lucky enough never to have that one, but I had some people who were by themselves who threw their back out, enjoying a quiet moment by themselves.
We don't need to go into more details than that. But we're joking about this, but it's a really serious job, and it's a really dangerous job, isn't it?
Yeah, as far as seriousness goes, not every call, obviously, is going to present with a life-threatening situation. But, plenty of them do, and even the ones that don't, you have an opportunity to make a difference in somebody's life when they're at a real low point. And that, it's not only a big responsibility, but, also something of an honor. But it is dangerous. We were sort of joking about driving an ambulance in traffic, but it is difficult to do, and it is very easy to cause a wreck or to get in a wreck. Not to mention that you just by definition, you have to go into dangerous neighborhoods, into dangerous situations, deal with volatile, desperate people. There's plenty of opportunity for you to get hurt.
You were doing this in Atlanta for Grady Hospital, which is in a part of town that you have a lot of low-income people there. You got a lot of drug problems. You got a lot of violence problems. When you would go out and answer a call, how much of that did you have to deal with?
Well, all of it. It happens quite a bit, especially, in some of the rougher areas. It might not be a call that suggests that there's going to be violence, but the type of people involved in it, have of a violent history or at least a violent tendency. So, obviously if someone's been shot or assaulted, they're going to send the police. But if it's someone who's sick and their boyfriend or their mother or father or their neighbor comes over and, these are people who find themselves on the wrong side of the law frequently, what started out as simply a respiratory distress call, can turn into a full-blown fight.
Were there situations where because you were in a vehicle with an ambulance and you were an authority figure, people turned against you?
I found that, generally speaking, that was sort of your passport into places you otherwise would not be allowed to go. But that's sort of a double-edged sword because on the one hand, you are recognized as, hey, these people are here to help. But occasionally you do find yourself in a situation where it's a little bit out of control and you have to kind of, flex your authority. And not everyone takes well to being told what to do, regardless of how diplomatic you are. And so, yeah, there are certainly times where someone will say, oh, you think you're in charge. Well, and now suddenly the dynamic has shifted, and you went from being the helper to, the guy coming in with a uniform, and suddenly people are looking at you in a totally different way. And you can feel the tension rise, and those situations can escalate to violence.
Are you talking about a patient who is resistant, or neighbors and family and friends?
All the above. Patients, for any number of reasons. I mean, some people, whether they're drunk or high, or maybe they have mental health issues, can be violent. Some people are just violent by nature. But oftentimes, the family will disagree with what you're doing, and they will have one thing in mind for what their expectations are. And then you have sort of, okay, this is the reality of the situation. And when those two things don't jive, sometimes people will turn on you very quickly.
So were people fighting you? I'm trying to think of somebody you've gone there to help, and you say, okay, we're going to take you to the hospital now. And they're saying, no, I am not going to the hospital.
Yeah. So if you are, there's this thing called implied consent, and that's when somebody is incapacitated, but a reasonable person would want to be taken to the hospital. You can't just walk up and say, hey, I'm taking you to the hospital, let's go. There has to be a good reason. And someone can say no, even if they have a good reason. But if for some reason they're incapacitated, they sort of lose the ability to make that decision, and you can do it for them. So, anyone who is drunk or high or a threat to themselves or others sort of loses that ability to say no, and then you have to find a way to convince them that, hey, look, this is in your best interest, let's do this. And usually you can do it through a diplomatic means. You learn how to talk people off the ledge and how to sort of approach them gently, because, we don't carry pepper spray or a gun or a baton or even a bulletproof vest. I mean, it's just you and a smile. And so you need to, you learn very quickly how to deal with people and to get them to see your way. But not everyone does. And certainly some people, as you're trying to convince them, they just suddenly spin on you. And next thing you know, they're throwing punches or they're trying to kick you or, they're jumping on you and you're in a full wrestling match in the middle of the street.
Talking with Kevin Hazard, his book is called 1,000 Naked Strangers, about his decade as a paramedic in Atlanta, Georgia. Fascinating story. We've got a big problem in the St. Louis area now with heroin. We're not alone. A lot of places around the country have this. And I've heard about this drug, I can't remember the name of it right now, that paramedics and police officers and others can carry with them, which they can inject and which instantly gets somebody out of the overdose situation they were in. Did you use that on your job, and was it helpful?
Yeah, we used it quite a bit. The drug's called Narcan, and as you said, it reverses. There's among the things that an opiate does is it sort of tells the body, hey, look, there's no reason to breathe. You just relax, and everything's going to be okay. And so that's how a heroin overdose turns fatal. The person, relaxes the central nervous system, they stop breathing, and they die. And so we would find them oftentimes, blue and not breathing, and you would give them the Narcan, and they would instantly start breathing. If you gave them enough, they would instantly wake up. So you had to sort of walk that fine line between getting someone to breathe and then getting someone to wake up, and suddenly their high is gone, and, that situation can turn ugly. But we use it quite a bit. It's a very helpful drug, and unfortunately, because of, the prescription opiates that were being handed out for so long, that problem that used to be kind of on the wane is now on the rise. And once people can no longer get those prescription drugs, they turn to something easier and cheaper, which, of course, is heroin. But it's also unregulated. You really don't know what you're getting. And it's a tricky drug, and a lot of people, incredibly addictive. And, as we're seeing, it's a huge problem. Not only does it destroy communities, but it destroys people very quickly. And the overdose rate from it is alarming.
So if you give them Narcan and that helps overcome the heroin overdose, what if they've also taken, what if they've done a speedball? So now they've taken heroin and cocaine. You've cured, you've kind of taken care of the heroin problem, but they still got the cocaine in their system.
Yeah, unfortunately, you've taken away the good cop, and all that's left is a bad cop. Speedballs, they're really tricky for that exact reason. They have, the two drugs kind of have a different half-life, and so they act differently. But in conjunction, they kind of, as long as everything is working well, and the person can sort of proceed all right. But, if they overdose and you give them the Narcan, instantly the effects of the heroin are gone, and all they have now is this head full of coke, and now he's got this very angry guy who jumps up off the floor, and he's furious and really coked out of his mind, and it's just you. And again, there's you and a smile, and you're the one who's done this to him. And they usually don't see that, hey, you know, had he not done this, I wouldn't be breathing right now.
What do you think you learned about the American healthcare system from your decade on that job?
You know, I really did, because if you take politics aside, and, you know, we can argue forever about, you know, how we all feel about public healthcare, but if you bring a patient into a doctor, a nurse, a paramedic, they aren't going to let that person lie on the floor and die. People are going to treat their patients. I mean, that's the central role of a healthcare provider. People are going to do it. So when you have people who, for whatever reason, don't have access to medications or can't afford medications or preventative care, what you wind up paying for is the catastrophic failure. So because they don't take their medicines, because they don't see doctors routinely, they wind up in the ICU, you know, with kidney failure or heart failure, or, you know, they don't take care of their high blood pressure or diabetes, and everything goes haywire, and they wind up with strokes or massive heart attacks. You know, you realize how incredibly difficult it is to get the proper care to at-risk populations, but then also how critical it is, because not only is it, you hate to see these people go through a situation, but we wind up with a much bigger, much more expensive problem than if we simply could have gotten this person normal preventative care.
You probably had people who saw you and your ambulance crew more often than they ever saw a doctor outside of a hospital.
Yeah, you know, that's the reality of emergency medicine, is that oftentimes people who don't have a regular physician or a regular dentist will call 911 and want to be either treated by the ambulance crew or want to be treated in the ER for something like a toothache that simply cannot be treated in the ER. And that's just emergency medicine. You know, they're really working hard now nationwide to try to find ways, you know, community outreach programs through EMS to try to fix this. But it's a big issue, and it's going to take a long time to get people to understand that an ambulance, a 911 ambulance anyway, is not, you know, your own personal house call.
Yeah, it's also not your personal Uber driver.
Yeah.
You had people who treated you that way, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. There are plenty of people who would call simply because they know that, hey, if I call 911, they have to give me a ride. And when I get downtown, maybe I just want to be downtown. Or maybe I have a doctor's appointment, so they'll take me to the hospital. And the moment you get there, they jump up and walk out the back door, and that's it. They're gone. And they never needed to go to the hospital. They simply needed to get downtown, and the bus charges up front, and the ambulance sends a bill that they can ignore.
This is an amazing life and an amazing career, and a really, really entertaining and informative book. Have you talked to Hollywood about it?
Yeah, you know, it started out as a blog, and some people read it, and I got a phone call from a guy who said, hey, you know, look, these are great stories. I'd love to be your agent. So it opened up a lot of doors, and, you know, I've certainly got a lot of phone calls, and a lot of people have made some offers to see what we can do better, because it is an incredible story. So, and it's true. It's happening right now in front of all of us, and hardly any of us have any idea that this strange subculture exists.
Well, congratulations on the career and also on the book, because it really took me inside a profession that I was always curious about and didn't know much about. And you not only write about your excitement in starting the job, but also your frustrations when you quit and everything that came in between. And it's a wonderful tale, well told. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
The book is called 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. His name is Kevin Hazard. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.